Hey gang, welcome to this episode of Uncle Josh's True Scary Stories. Enjoy a few minutes of terror and madness, and then consider checking out my merchandise store, UncleJoshTrueScaryStories.threadless.com. It's not pretty, but it is working. Also, stay tuned for an announcement about the first live virtual campfire coming up soon. That'll be your chance to tell your story to everyone else in a live stream right here on my channel. As always, share your stories with me, UncleJoshTrueScaryStories@gmail.com. Now, gather around the fire. Let's get it on. Uncle Tom by Dina. For several consecutive summers, my friend Tristan worked in a summer camp in upstate New York. The camp catered to children with disabilities, mental and otherwise, but there were also some non-disabled children there. One night, while Tristan was chatting with some of his older counselors, they began talking about a counselor he'd never met, a guy they called Uncle Tom. Uncle Tom had worked as a counselor during the late 70s, and he was much loved by the children there, but very eccentric. He was known for wearing pajamas all day, bathrobes, even a graduation gown, complete with mortarboard and tassel. At first, they all thought he just did it to amuse the kids, but they later found out that he dressed that way year-round. He was also an amazingly talented cellist. A charcoal portrait of Uncle Tom, done by one of the children, still hung at the camp when Tristan was there. Unfortunately, Uncle Tom had emotional problems that no one knew about. One summer, just before all the children were about to leave, he attempted suicide in one of the cabins. Luckily, someone came looking for him and got him medical help before it was too late. And that winter, Uncle Tom was in and out of psychiatric institutions. By summer, however, he seemed to have really gotten his act together and was allowed to return to the camp. His recovery was short-lived. At the end of the summer, he attempted suicide again, and this time he succeeded, hanging himself in the same cabin he had used the year before. The children were scheduled to leave the following day, and the other counselors managed to cover up what had happened. By the time Tristan began working at the camp, the head director had firmly told all of the counselors that they were not to speak of the incident, or of Uncle Tom at all, in general, as it would scare the children. That year, they started off with a fresh crop of children who knew nothing about Uncle Tom, and the summer went well. Well, until just before it was time to leave. The night before, no kidding, on the exact anniversary of Uncle Tom's death, an entire cabin full of girls aged 13 to 15 began to scream hysterically. There was a female counselor in the cabin with them at the time, and some were sobbing uncontrollably and saying that they'd seen a man in the cabin. A man they didn't know. These were non-disabled children, if that makes any difference. Tristan was one of the first to get there, and he was comforting the female counselor, who was also crying. He remembers her saying over and over again, "It looked like Tom. I mean, it looked just like Tom." After a thorough search, no intruder was found in the grounds, and nobody had been seen leaving the cabin. The next year that Tristan was there, the camp was having a dress-up day. The kids got to search through the boxes of old clothing and costumes and wear anything they liked for the entire day. One boy found the black graduation gown that had belonged to Uncle Tom. I'd like to mention at this point that this boy suffered severe mental issues and was classified as low-functioning. He was barely able to talk. Tristan said he had never known the boy to speak at all unless spoken to, and even then, not more than a few short words. Well, the boy put on the black gown and began to run around in circles, flapping his arm, calling out, "I'm Uncle Tom! I'm Uncle Tom!" over and over. Tristan said there was no way this particular kid could have associated the gown with Uncle Tom, or even understood the whole story if someone had told it to him. Suffice to say, the counselors were a little freaked. The next year, some of the counselors decided to get together and have a jam session. One guy had a guitar, another played piano, and the music room still housed Uncle Tom's cello, so they thought it might be cool to add that in as well. They asked a third counselor, who had a little experience playing the violin, to play the cello. He reluctantly agreed, warning them that he was not very good. No sooner did they start playing, they realized that their cellist was incredible. They said he was playing the thing like one of the old masters, I mean, really, really well. After it was over, they all asked him why he'd been holding out on them about how talented he was. He couldn't remember anything about playing the cello. He said he'd blacked out the entire time. All the older counselors commented that they'd only heard one other person play like that. Yeah, guess who it was? Those were the only three incidents that Tristan experienced. He said he suspected there were more, but the counselors really weren't supposed to talk about it. Tristan and a lot of the other counselors seemed to share the feeling that the reason Uncle Tom was making himself known was because he wanted his story to be told. He wanted people to talk about him. Tristan thinks that if the head director had never forbidden the counselors to talk about Tom, then he wouldn't need to manifest. The camp has since closed down. Something Breathing in the Darkness, submitted by Painkiller. First, let me give you a little background information. In my 20s, I worked at the state docks where container ships would come in and offload their cargo. Not so creepy, huh? Well, I worked third shift, 11 p.m. to 7 a.m., and the only people who were supposed to be on this property at night were me and the port police. I forgot to mention that I was the only one on my shift in my corner of the port. The second shift guys and the longshoremen were leaving as I would arrive at work, and to be completely honest, I liked the fact that I didn't have anyone looking over my shoulder while I worked, so it gave me the freedom to get the yard set up how I wanted it for the next day. With that background out of the way, here's my story. I arrived at work like always at about 10:45 p.m. I got the rundown of what equipment was needed for the next day, and then the second shift crew left all at once. So I walk out into the yard and I look at how the jockey trucks and trailers are parked, and knew that everything needed to be reparked and serviced, so I got to work servicing the trucks immediately. I had to park the trucks and trailers in the order I was going to be sending them out in the morning. After working for about 2.5 hours, I was over halfway finished, so I decided a break was in order. Since I didn't have a supervisor standing over me all the time, I could do things in whatever order I wanted, including taking breaks. So now I'll give you a layout of the property. Leaving our yard, on your immediate right are two very long warehouses, and each of them are no less than 2 football fields in length and 1.5 football fields deep. When one ends, the next one starts about 50 feet away. They were in a single file formation. In the first warehouse, the port used to store lumber coming in from overseas. In the second warehouse, they stored things in wooden crates that were odd sizes and weights, but the crates were 14 to 17 feet high. Also in the second warehouse, at the very end, was a break room where a couple of vending machines were. Since we had no vending machines at the company I worked for, the port let us use their break machines. And, since it was the beginning of October and it had become unseasonably cold for southeast Georgia, I used our service truck to drive down to the second warehouse and get out of the cold for a few minutes. I drove down to the break room and drove up the ramp to enter the warehouse. Pulled inside and cut the truck off and got out. And I'm sure that I don't have to describe what complete and utter silence sounds like, but that's how deathly quiet it was in that warehouse. Quiet and dark. The kind of dark where you can't see your hand 2 inches from your face dark. I knew where everything I needed was in that warehouse, so I didn't bother using my mag light. I got out of the truck and walked the 10 or so feet to the door of the break room, and I opened it. I took my left hand and placed it on the wall inside the break room by my right shoulder and flicked on the lights. The fluorescent bulbs flickered until the ballast kicked in and lit up the room. So I went in and made my selections from both machines, and then sat down in one of the chairs for just a minute, just because, and then I popped the top of my Pepsi and took a long pull. Even though it was pretty chilly out, that cold drink was refreshing and just what the doctor ordered. And of course, after that long first pull, I had only just a swig left in that can, so I got another one and then turned off the light in the break room and headed back to the service truck. I opened the door to the truck after I dropped the can in the recycling bin and climbed inside. I got in, closed the door, and popped the top on my second Pepsi and took another swig. What happened next will stay with me until my last breath. I heard someone or something take a very deep and ragged breath. I froze. I'm not a small man by any stretch of the imagination. I stand 6'2 and weigh 245 pounds, and I don't spook easily. I listened for perhaps another breath or something, and I heard what I could describe only as metal being dragged across concrete. Right then, it was time for me to nope the fuck out of there. I started up the truck, backed out of the warehouse, went down the ramp, and immediately began driving to the Port Police office. Nobody was supposed to be in that building. Nobody but me and the Port Police were supposed to be in the port. So I got to the Port Police office in about 2 minutes. I went in and explained what I had heard and where I think it came from. They followed me to my yard, and two officers searched it, and three officers searched the warehouse. There's plenty of places to hide in the yard, and I waited in the office until they finished with their search. They came in and were taking my statement for the record, and just as I started, their radio crackles to life, and I heard one of the officers calling from the warehouse. 110 to 118. 110 to 118. Please report to Break Bulk 2. Break Bulk 2 was the warehouse I had heard the breath and the metal dragging across the concrete. The officer said they'd be right back in a few minutes, and I needed to wait in my office until they got back. At this point, it was around 2:45 in the morning, and I still had about an hour's worth of work to be ready for a 7 a.m. dispatch. The officer finally returned an hour later and asked me to come with him, so I did as I was told. I could see that all of the lights in the second warehouse were on as we drove down to the end and drove up the ramp to enter the warehouse. When the officer stopped his cruiser, I could see the other four police officers near a huge wooden crate that looked to be about 15 feet high. They were taking pictures and pointing at something. Then the officer opened my door and I got out. He led me over to where his colleagues were gathered and asked me, "Could this have possibly made the dragging sound you heard?" He was pointing to a scythe. My eyes got huge when I saw it. I stuttered a bit and said, maybe? I was fucking freaking out, like, what the fuck? What kind of person would do something like that? The port is a secure location. There's at least two officers at every point of entry and electrified and razor wire fences all around the place. They told me they didn't find anyone in the warehouse. In fact, the only thing they found other than the scythe were two drops of blood. After the police officer finally took my statement, they had to report it to our big boss on the first shift, who just so happens to come in every morning at 6 a.m., and I ended up in his office for the last hour of my shift. He could see that I was kind of fried, and he gave me the next week off with pay. Unfortunately, this is by no means my last creepy story from this job. I worked there for 5 years, and there's lots more where this one came from. I Didn't Belong to Him, submitted by Brina M. I was working at a small, double-sided drive-through-only coffee stand about 30 minutes outside of Seattle. I'd been working there for about a year at this point, and was always scheduled to work the closing shift during the week, and the opening shift on the weekends. In the 7 years I had worked as a barista at this point, I had never been confronted with a situation that challenged my feeling of security while working there. And, despite having heard numerous stories over the years of other baristas in the area who had suffered violent or dangerous interactions with some of their customers, I considered myself fortunate not to have to place myself among them. Unfortunately, on this day, that would change. Thursday, November 7th, 6:45 p.m. I was preparing to close the stand at 7 p.m. like usual. It was very rare that I would have customers come through the stand past 6:30. And because of this, I felt myself jump slightly when I looked up from the espresso machine I was cleaning to see a man standing behind the glass of the closed window beside me. Adding to my alarm was the fact that he made no noise whatsoever as he approached the stand, and made no attempt to grab my attention once he got there. Instead, he stood behind the window in complete silence, his mouth awkwardly fixed into an unnatural-looking smile. At first, I wasn't even sure if he was a customer at all, considering the idea he may be part of a large group of transients and homeless that were known at that time to reside in the area, and who occasionally came up to the stand to ask for free coffee or water. For safety reasons, I typically refrained from serving walk-up customers after dusk, but because he now knew I had seen him, the rules of good customer service required I at least acknowledge the fact that he was there. So, reluctantly, I decided to serve him. He introduced himself as Ivan. He was around my age, seemed reasonably well-kept in the sense that his clothing and overall appearance looked pretty clean, and despite a slight Eastern European accent, his English was very good. His eyes, however, were utterly unnerving. His gaze made my stomach feel uneasy, and immediately my intuition was alerting me that something about this individual was very wrong. Every red flag possible was beginning to show in my mind, and I could not shake the deep, almost overwhelming sense of darkness that I felt coming from this person. There was an evil in him that I couldn't ignore, though I would soon find out exactly why I was feeling this way. After greeting him as politely as I could manage, despite my growing hesitations, I began preparing my machine to make him a drink. However, he didn't seem to know what he wanted to order, and I asked him twice what I could get started for him before I silently recognized the fact he was not likely here for the coffee. Eventually, he abandoned ordering altogether and instead directed our interaction towards small talk. He asked me where I was from, how long I'd been working at this stand, etc. I answered each of these questions with short, abrupt answers, hoping my tone and clear lack of engagement would convey the fact I wasn't interested in continuing any further conversation. Besides, he was not a paying customer, and I was about to close. After a long pause, he asked slowly, "So, do you have a boyfriend?" Annoyed, I replied curtly, "No." At this point, I was completely ready to end our interaction, so I told him that I needed to finish closing up so that I could go home. And upon hearing this, he walked away from the window he'd been standing at, mentioning in his descent that he was looking forward to seeing me again very soon. A minute or so passed, and he was out of sight. Yet my gut told me he was not, however, far away. I could feel his dark energy nearby, and I knew he was watching me from somewhere beyond my line of vision. Cautiously, I closed up the stand, locked the doors and windows, and walked to my car and drove home. By the following day, I had all but forgotten the encounter I had had with that guy, and I went to work as usual. 7 p.m. rolled around, and once again, I was just about to end my shift and close the stand. I was nearly finished closing out the register when a brief moment of movement catched my eye from outside the window on the opposite side of the stand. I turned my head toward the area in question, and there, in full view of both me and the security cameras, stood the guy from yesterday. My stomach sank quicker than I knew previously to be possible, and I was immediately very aware of how cold it was inside of that stand. He smiled at me with a predatory-like grin, waved, and then proceeded to pull open the closed window in front of him, instead of waiting for me to cross the small distance within the stand that stood between us and open it for him, as I usually would. Although he didn't present himself aggressively, there was something incredibly threatening about his choosing to do that, and it left me feeling helplessly, hopelessly unsafe in that moment. And that was not a feeling I was familiar with, or, as I learned, particularly fond of. Once I was finally able to bring myself back into a present state of mind again, I cleared my throat and told him as firmly as possible that I was off the clock and wouldn't be able to make anything for him as my machine was already cleaned and my register closed out for the day. His smile widened further as he replied, "That's okay. I didn't come for the coffee. I came for you." Upon hearing this, I noticed a shift in the energy building between us. The fear I'd previously been overcome with now made a sudden and jolting transition into a redlining level of irritation. "I don't care what you came for," I told him as sternly as I could manage. "It's going to have to wait until tomorrow, because I am fucking closed. At this, he chuckled a bit before finally raising both his hands in an indication of surrender, saying, all right, fair enough. His smile disappeared. His eyes became even more focused on me. His gaze intensified. Then I will see you tomorrow, he said, in a way that felt less like a statement and more like a threat. I swallowed hard, and once he was out of view, I rushed to the window and slammed it shut, throwing the lock into place. Again, despite not being able to visibly confirm his presence nearby, I knew he was there, and I could feel his eyes fixated upon me. I left the stand quickly and got into my car to drive home. This time, however, he remained heavily on my mind for the rest of the night, robbing me entirely of any sleep. The following morning was a Saturday, so per my schedule, I got up insanely early to work the 5 a.m. opening shift. I arrived at the stand at 5:10, and for the first few hours of my shift, everything was as it would normally be. 8:30 rolled around, and it's now finally no longer freezing and dark outside, as the November mornings here tend to be. The sun had broken through the clouds and was steadily burning them off. As I was admiring the weather out the window of the stand, I noticed a familiar truck approaching. As it neared closer, I recognized it as my ex-boyfriend, Jonathan. I found this exceptionally odd, as he and I were not currently on very friendly terms due to his cheating that ended our relationship about 6 months earlier. He pulled up slowly to the ledge of the open window I was occupying, and I asked him what he was doing there. I'm sure I'm probably not someone you were wanting to see today, I know, but I just wanted to come by and wish you a happy birthday and see how you were doing. Just as I was about to thank him for the birthday wishes and inform him that, no, indeed, he isn't someone I wanted to see that day, as I was still pretty hurt from his cheating, I noticed someone about 100 yards away, approaching the stand on foot. It was Ivan. I whispered quickly to Jonathan that I needed him to stay here with me, even if another customer pulled in for service behind him, until the guy who just walked up was gone. I could tell he was able to register the fear in my eyes, and he agreed immediately to stay. I brought as much focus into my demeanor as I could manage at that time, and turned to face the window on the opposite side of the stand, just as Ivan approached it. I walked slowly over to him, and noticed right away that he'd been crying. His eyes were bloodshot, and a few tears dripped down his cheeks slowly. Disregarding his obvious emotional state, I informed him he needed to leave, as I was not going to serve him. But before my statement reached its conclusion, he cut my words off abruptly. "I don't need this anymore. You can have it." As he said this, he threw what I later came to recognize as his Russian passport right into the stand through the open window. I picked it up, puzzled, and with a mix of both caution and disinterest, I asked him why he would no longer be needing it. "I just won't." I allowed his words to hang heavily between us while I attempted to make some sense in my mind of what a gesture like this might mean, if anything at all. That was before I felt a strong bite of dread inside my chest. The fear crept slowly into my throat before finally escaping past my lips in an audible gasp, bringing Ivan the confirmation he'd been hoping for, that I understood what was about to happen here. No guest to a foreign country would willingly discard or abandon their passport unless they intended to see to completion an act of absolute finality. In an effort to sever the nonverbal conversation taking place within the locked gaze Ivan and I currently had on one another, I glanced over my shoulder at Jonathan, who now had a "what-the-fuck-is-going-on" look on his face. In an instant, he recognized the desperate, pleading fear in my eyes. This caused his own expression to quickly change to one of panicked urgency as he attempted to understand what had just taken place between this stranger and myself. As I turned back to Ivan and noticed immediately that his crying had stopped, his tears were now replaced with a look of what I can only describe as complete and utter insanity. This is the point where the dynamics of our interaction shifted indefinitely. "God came to me last night in my dreams," he began slowly. "He told me you will be my wife. You are my wife. You are mine. You are for me." A sickening, sadistic smile curled the corners of his mouth up in such a way that it was almost physically painful to witness. My heart began throwing itself violently against the inside of my chest as adrenaline surged through my system. "You are my wife," he stated again. "You are my wife, and now you come with me. Right now." At this, he planted his hands firmly onto the ledge of the window that stood before him, and he began to lift himself onto it. Realizing that he was attempting to crawl through the window and into the stand, I practically threw myself across the small distance between he and I quickly slammed the window shut, locking it. He pushed his weight back down off the ledge, paused, and then proceeded to give me a look that made me truly understand the meaning of having one's blood run cold. I felt the inside of me begin to quiver in a way that I'd never felt before, an anxious vibration that was working its way throughout my entire body. This was not over yet. I understood that now. At this, Ivan offered me a quick wink and began to move with obvious purpose towards the back of the stand. Soon, I heard a faint beep, 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 beep of buttons being punched on the electronic keyboard that secured the lock on the back door. Ivan was trying to get through the only actual entrance to the stand. In my mind, I knew there was no way he would ever manage to guess the 4-number code, and dismissed any arising concerns that he would manage to gain entry. "Not going to be that easy," I said under my breath, though I was unsure if I truly believed that. A sudden realization I'd spoken far too soon arrived like a dead weight thrown directly at my gut. The dread that followed what I heard next is something I will never forget. It slammed itself violently into my present state of mind, and with so much force, I almost fell back a few steps. Adrenaline immediately overtook my system in its entirety, and in an instant, my vision tunneled itself. As I heard the fateful sound of the electronic keypad indicating a successful code entry, followed by the loud and heavy thunk of the steel deadbolt retreating quickly back into the door, all I could see was the door in front of me. Nothing else. It was as if there were a glaring spotlight illuminating that door, and the evil that was about to walk through it. All else around me fell into darkness. Time felt as if it had stopped entirely, and I no longer had a sense of it, or the space around me in which I currently occupied. As the door began to slowly push open from the outside, I could hear an almost deafening scream resonate powerfully throughout the walls of the stand, expelled solely by a force of fear. As I stood there completely paralyzed, I bore witness to the largest knife I had ever seen enter through the opening door first, followed by Ivan's firmly gripped hand around it. It was only then that I realized the scream I was hearing was my own. As Ivan passed the remainder of his body through the opening of the back door and into the stand, my scream suddenly silenced itself. Before I continue any further, let me just say that until you personally experience a situation that demands you access your fight-or-flight response, you have no idea what the response is going to ultimately be. The type of fear that's required to trigger this defense mechanism in the first place is more than most people ever realize. How you will react to it will be involuntary. In this moment, I recognize the simple fact that regardless of whatever it is this guy had planned for me here today, I intended to survive it. And not simply survive. I intended to execute a lesson this guy clearly needed to learn. Never underestimate someone's capability to persevere, or the fight that drives them. Remembering at this point, Jonathan was still in his truck on the other side of the stand, I ran to the window and screamed desperately through the now closed and locked panel of glass. "Jonathan! Jonathan, he's got a fucking knife!" Jonathan's eyes grew huge, and he threw open the driver's side door and flew from his truck towards the back of the building. Then, in the furthest corner of my vision, I caught sight of a dark, looming presence enter the space of the small interior of the stand. Ivan, now standing no further than 10 feet from me, reeked of an evil that overtook every inch of space within the small building we now occupied together. It made the air so heavy around me that breathing started to become difficult. It felt thick and toxic in my lungs and nearly caused me to choke. As my struggle to breathe increased, Ivan began to close the few feet of space still between us by taking slow, taunting steps in my direction. His knife was gripped firmly in his hand, which rested at his side, but the look he had on his face in this moment was so intense that it felt as if it were made of its own blade. He used his eyes to cut into me, deeply, over and over again, and spoke softly through the visual violence. "You are my wife. You are my wife." Ivan ultimately only managed to take a total of 3 steps towards me before I saw an arm being thrown around his neck from behind. As I stood there in a state of paralysis due to fear, I watched as Jonathan pulled Ivan back by the neck with so much force his feet flew out from beneath him. Suddenly, both Ivan and Jonathan were on the ground, right outside the door, with Jonathan securing Ivan in a headlock that proved nearly impossible to break away from. Jonathan yelled strict instructions for Ivan to not move, not a single muscle, or he would choke the fucking life out of him. Surprisingly, Ivan remained completely still, never once making any sign of resistance. Jonathan kicked the knife away from his reach and told me to pick it up and secure it until the cops arrived. Upon hearing this, I finally remembered I was still on the phone with 911, who had heard what was happening on my end and dispatched every available unit within a 30-mile radius to my location, marking my call in their response system as the highest priority. It felt like hours before the cops arrived, but once I had a chance to look back on the duration of my call to 911, I realized it had been a mere 4 minutes before 20 local, city, county, and sheriff's department vehicles overtook the area. At least 6 cops descended on Ivan at once, relieving the grip Jonathan had around his neck, and forcibly, more than necessary to my silent pleasure, they were detaining Ivan and carrying him, practically hogtied, into a waiting cruiser. Apparently, while speaking with the cops after being securely restrained and unable to flee, Ivan insisted, continually, that I was his wife. God had told him, after all, that I was intended for him. I belonged to him, God said. He was simply there that morning to collect that which he had been promised. Weekend House Sitting by Bigfoot Hunter. The following events happened when I was around 5. The stories that I'm sharing are partially from my own recollection and partly conveyed to me by my father and older sibling. I went to visit my father for a weekend, as I did every other weekend ever since I could remember. I was told this weekend we would be staying somewhere else to help house sit for a family that was out of town, and that excited me. Upon arriving at the house, it was quite apparent that the house was very old and somewhat run down from being lived in for many, many years. There were numerous events that took place throughout the weekend, which could not be described by anything other than the paranormal. The first event took place as soon as we walked into the house. There was a dead frog on the floor, which was unsettling in hindsight and somewhat kind of foreshadowing for the events that were about to take place, but we didn't pay much attention to the cynical aspect of it, more so making a joke about it and high hopes for an amazing weekend away from the city. The second event took place the night of our arrival once everyone was in bed, supposedly sleeping. My sister and her friend were playing with a Ouija board, and I believe that was a mistake. The board had shared with her that they were talking with a boy who was 16 years old when he had died in the military, and that his name was, well, let's say Fred. While my sister and her friend were communicating with Fred, she couldn't believe that my father was letting me and another child my age run around the house at such a late hour, running up and down the stairs, talking, laughing, and banging around in the room next to hers. The house had hardwood floors, which made it very apparent when people were walking around, especially the creaky stairs. The Ouija board then started repeatedly saying, "door," and the arrow was pointing in the direction outside of the room. When my sister went to see what it was pointing at, there was a door at the end of the hallway that led onto an old balcony that was no longer safe to stand on. This door was nailed shut and would not open when my sister tried to force it open. When it was time for breakfast in the morning, my sister came down to have my father scold her for staying up too late and making so much noise. When she had stated that her and her friend were quietly playing board games, and that she had suspected it was me and my friend making all the noise, my father simply replied that my friend and I were sleeping in the room next to him, and were quite asleep early, and not making any noise. That's when we started to suspect that the house had something going on beyond more than what we were seeing with our eyes. The next event was during that Saturday when my father was rummaging around in one of the empty bedrooms, exploring all the house's gems from previous residents. The room had a dresser, a closet, and a door that swung into the room. I remember that. While checking out the room, he had been notified by his significant other that we had run the well dry and that we needed to go into town for some water in case we didn't get the well back running again. Before leaving for town, we headed into the basement where the well was and checked to make sure that the pump was still working properly and to see if there was water in the bottom. While in the basement, we decided to check out the crawl space, which had old mementos from the past. Old photo albums, which contained quite graphic and disturbing content, such as black and white photos of children of Asian descent, holding up dead chickens with their heads cut off, seeming to be trophies for them of some sort. The most disturbing part was seeing a framed picture on the wall of the basement of a young man in his military uniform, and a label below the photo that read, "Fred." When we went into town to get the water, we had stated that we were staying in this old house, and the cashier seemed to be quite familiar with it, having driven past it to work every morning and evening. She seemed to be unsettled about the house in particular, warning us that there was something strange about it. On several occasions, she had driven past the house and seen people standing on the balcony, but then blinked and realized that there was no one there, and her eyes must have been playing tricks on her. When we arrived back at the house, my father had decided to go back and check out the room that he had been in before we got interrupted. When he tried to open the door, it seemed to be jammed, but he hadn't closed it as far as he could recall. When he had put some force into the door and made it open, he realized that the dresser had been pushed up against the back of the door in a way that prevented it from being opened. The dresser's contents were strewn all over the room, but the window was not open, and being on the second floor, it was hard to imagine how someone could press the dresser against the back of the door and then get out of the room. This was the last event that I recall in the house, and we had left, but my father's significant other and her children were still obligated to be in the house for the pre-negotiated duration of her house sitting. The next morning, we got a call from her when she was in a panic. The door that had led to the balcony was now wide open, with the hardware thrown on the floor that was previously holding it shut. What Happened at Sanderson Brook Falls by Ronan. My friend Chris and I went for a night hike out at Sanderson Brook Falls, a steep uphill march in the Berkshire region of western Massachusetts. The drive out there takes close to an hour, most of it along U.S. Route 20, also known as the Jacob's Ladder Trail. Winding its way between mountains, hills, and a river, the route takes drivers through Westfield, a fairly well-populated college town, and then on through Russell, Huntington, Chester, and if you keep going past Chester State Forest, it will continue to run parallel to the Massachusetts Turnpike into Beckett, and eventually to Lee. As usual, Chris missed the turnoff onto the narrow and overgrown dirt road that went a quarter of a mile into the trees, and then turned off downhill into a grassy little clearing where we parked. There was a larger parking area out front. The area was completely concealed from the road, so we wouldn't have any cops waiting to ticket us when we got back for being in the park after dark. Putting the BMW in reverse, Chris brought his car back to the dirt road and pulled forward into it. I commented on the fact that there were two cars in the roadside parking area ahead. Parking the car, I realized that we hadn't brought a flashlight like we usually do, so Chris dug the crappy flashlight that comes standard in a BMW's glove box out. It was fairly bright out for so long after nightfall, a full moon illuminating to a point that the flashlight would only become necessary if we had to pass through a particularly dark patch in the woods. A crisp autumn breeze reminded me to throw on my jacket before we started out. Marching up the wide path that led up a mile or so into the woods, we were talking about whatever BS popped into our heads. Work, movies, books, whatever. It wasn't until we got past the first quarter mile area that things started getting strange. Ahead of us, four people were coming towards us in the shaded darkness of the broad path. I could see patches of detail as they passed through the brighter areas where the moonlight made it to the dirt. I thought to myself how odd it was that there were four people, three men and one woman, for two cars. Four would have easily fit into either of the cars, and why waste the gas driving out in the middle of nowhere with two cars? I knew they weren't locals, as the cars had both been Volkswagens, and not pickup trucks, and their clothes looked like nice, preppy college kid clothes. The girl was in a peacoat, the guys in nondescript gray and black jackets. I assumed they were college kids who came up here to drink around a campfire, although none of them seemed to be carrying a cooler or anything. I nodded to the four as we passed, and one of the men nodded back, but he had an odd, curious look on his face. No word was spoken between our two groups, and they continued on. I looked to my watch and saw that it was only a little after 10:30 p.m., an odd time to stop drinking and go home on a Saturday night. I commented on that to Chris after the four were out of our hearing range, and he said they were probably just out here for the same reason we were, just having a night hike. It seemed logical enough for me, so I dismissed the troop we had just passed as nothing other than interesting. So when we passed the next group of three on our way up the hill, I thought nothing of that as well. I just assumed they were the occupants of the other car and were either completely unrelated to the first group or were stragglers. They were all dressed similarly, in uninteresting dark colors. The three were all guys, and as they passed, one of them asked us what time it was. I told him, not stopping as I did. They thanked us and were soon behind us, disappearing into the darkness. Now, up until this point, you're probably saying to yourself that there was nothing weird about any of this. Well, all of that doesn't become weird until I get to this part. Another quarter of a mile brought us to the Horde. We had just crossed the first of the two small iron bridges that were on the path. The bridges were separated by maybe a quarter of a mile and spanned over 10-foot drop-offs with fast-running streams at the bottoms. The streams fed into the river after the falls. As the next group of people came into view, I had difficulty distinguishing just how many people it was, and I realized after the fact that it was because there were just too many of them. They must have had numbered close to 50, all dressed in the same manner as those we had passed already. Nothing odd about their clothes, other than that all of them seemed to be dressed nicely. Dark pea coats, waistcoats, and leather jackets on every person. A couple of the women had scarves. Everyone in the group I could see seemed to be roughly the same age, that being in their early 20s. I scanned the incoming mass for coolers or any sign that this was a disbanding kegger, and saw nothing of the sort. As we moved amidst the opposing traffic, I was trying to think of how all these people had gotten here if there were only two cars at the bottom of the hill. While I was pondering this, I found out later, one of the passing women had spoken to Chris saying, "You're going the wrong way, dear," almost dreamily, and then she continued on. Other than that, there was almost no sign that any of these people were even seeing us. As we kept walking, the strangers continued to file past. We kept walking, and for a while I was sure that this flow of people was going to be never-ending. Chris and I didn't speak to each other. We just looked to each other with occasional confusion and kept on pushing forward. Then the tail end of this mass came into view, and just now crossing the second bridge. We reached just before the iron-grated deck of the bridge as the last of them were getting off of it. There were about 10 of them in this small grouping, and at either side of this group were two men who were slightly shorter than the rest of the men around them. Both were Asian or Pacific Islanders by appearance. I moved to pass on the right, and Chris went to the left. As I tried to go around the short man on my side, he moved in my way, blocking me from stepping onto the bridge, ranting someone in what seemed to be absolute gibberish, and I later came to realize reminded me a lot of the Filipino language Tagalog. He sounded like boiling water, but I could tell he didn't want me to pass. He tucked his shoulder into my chest as though trying to push me into turning around. I put my hand out, shoved him aside, not liking the way the situation was going, and I angrily said, "Move!" The shorter man was forced out of the way by my palm, and though he glared at me angrily, he made no effort to get back on the bridge to follow me. Looking to my left, I saw that Chris was now getting onto the bridge, and he had an angry and confused look on his face as well. He told me that the short Asian man on his side had actually grabbed his wrist and tried to hold him back. Chris had pulled his hand free and just kept on walking, and he commented that the man had been talking gibberish. I told him what had happened on my side, and we both stopped, thinking for a second once we were over the bridge. We turned and watched the last of the large group disappear into the gloom. "That was damn surreal," I said. "Yeah, it was. What were they, cultists or something?" Chris said back. Starting forward again with no intentions of heading back down the hill any time soon, we only made it a few yards before more people appeared. This time, though, it was only three guys, but these three were dressed in sweatsuits, and they were running down the hill. They stopped very briefly, as though catching their breath, and we saw that they were also of about the same age as the rest of those we had seen earlier. They looked exhausted, though, and after their moment's rest, they launched into a fast-paced jog down the hill towards we had seen the mass of strangers go only moments before. Back toward the Tagalog brothers and the Wrong Way girl. Shaking my head at the absolute absurdity of all that we had just seen, Chris and I continued walking, reaching the off-turn to the big waterfall, and took it. We walked in silence for a few minutes, and then began speculating on what had happened. I was very surprised and a little disconcerted when we reached the base of the waterfall and saw there was no evidence of a party. This was one of a three good party spots in the Sanderson Brook Falls area of Chester State Forest. One of the other two was out near the road, well before the large group of people. This left only the big clearing that was back next to the creepy freestanding ancient chimney. After taking a break and having a smoke next to the falls, we decided to forego climbing the waterfall and go back up to the main path to check out the chimney spot. Curiosity had gotten the better of us, and by the time we reached the clearing, we were unsurprised to see that there were only the smoldering remains of a small fire. We took the overgrown stone stairs up into the small area where the giant chimney stood, and even though we had camped right in front of the chimney before and had been up here many times, I don't think that chimney ever seemed creepier than it did that night. But again, there was no evidence of any party. It was a weird walk back down to the car, mostly silent, and the conversation that did happen was always strangely off the subject of the strangers. When we got back to our car, there was no sign of any of the people, and the two cars were gone. To this day, I wondered what all those people were doing up on the mountain that night, where they had gone to with only two cars for nearly 60 people, and why we had been going the wrong way. The Guy Across the Street, submitted by Howler Monkey Madness. This story is about the time my family moved from the city to the country. My dad decided to start his own business after building up another one and had made a whole lot of money and decided to do his own thing. At first, my twin sisters were super against moving, but they got over it when they realized that they would still be going to their private school and just driving themselves with a car my dad bought them. I was 2 years younger and in 10th grade, and I was happy to go to public school, wherever, because I hated the Jesuit school I was forced to go to until high school. I liked my friends, but man, I hated it there. We moved from a nice suburb of St. Louis to a place in Illinois about 40 minutes away. It was a big house surrounded by farms and only one neighbor across the street. One of the cool perks of being the lone guy was that my dad said I could have the finished room over the garage all to myself, and when I was a senior, I could move my room up there for good. It was awesome. I had a sweet setup there with a big TV, my games and computer, comfy furniture, and there was even a bathroom and a kitchen. I was smart. I never kept my beer in the big fridge. I had that hidden out of sight. Anyway, when we moved, it was early summer, and I hadn't met a lot of people that I'd be going to school with. But I did get a job at a local fast food restaurant and met some cool people there, and some of them I'm still friends with to this day. This story involves my friend Devin, who I met there. I hated to admit this when I was younger, but my sisters were really pretty and always had guys chasing them. Most of them were prep stuff, too, and the type of guys I didn't like. You know, the studs or whatever. But really, they were just spoiled dicks that bullied everyone else. I never liked my sister's boyfriends, but I was the baby brother nonetheless. That summer, my parents were going to celebrate their anniversary on a trip, and they left the three of us home to take care of ourselves. Of course, Kara and Katie were going to throw a party, which meant I was going to invite Devin over, and we would get some beer out of it and then see all the girls in action. I helped my parents load up the truck for their trip to the airport, and when they pulled out, I saw the neighbor guy across the road just standing in his yard staring. He was a big guy, well over 6 feet, but he just seemed like he wasn't all there. I mean, he was nice and all and never caused anybody any harm, but my sisters always complained that he stared at them too much and that he didn't take his hands out of his pants when he did stare. I didn't see him too much, but I knew his name was Ben and he worked for his dad on their farm. I waved a little and he waved back, and then I went inside to find my sisters calling all of their friends to tell them about the party. I told them I was inviting Devin over, and they said that was fine, but not to be a nuisance. Yeah, whatever. The night of the party came, and there were about 25 people wandering around the house, getting wasted and crazy. Devin and I hung out with the older people for a while, playing drinking games and checking out all the chicks my sisters were friends with. For some reason, the guys weren't being total douchebags that night, but this one guy who liked one of my sisters was really drunk and showing it. He was stumbling all over, he threw up in our living room, and then kept trying to make out with Katie. His friends were doing their best to get him to either sit down or leave, but he got really angry and started yelling shit about my sister being a slut and how she just fucked her way around. I got really pissed. I grabbed a cup of beer and whipped it at his face and then punched him. He was bigger than me, but I wasn't a small fry and a lot more sober than him. His friends started laughing, and he took a swing at me, missed, fell over, and I jumped on him before people pulled me off. He got to his feet, and the guys led him to the back door, which he slammed while yelling more stuff about my sister. When he slammed it, the entire window shattered and fell into the foyer. Great. Something for me to fix tomorrow, I thought. The guy left. Around 2, the party broke up, and almost everyone left except for a couple of my sister's friends. They were all pretty saucy, and while I was buzzing, neither Devin and I were that messed up. The girls got some water and went up to my sister's rooms while Devin and I locked the house up, patched up the door with a piece of cardboard, and went to my place above the garage. We cracked some more beers open and were going to play GTA for a while, and then we heard a noise from outside. It sounded like feet slipping on the driveway. So I went to look and noticed it was drizzling out, and everything looked shiny in the light of our floodlight out in the driveway. I didn't see anything and stood there swigging beer and listening to Dev play the game. I wish I had looked around more, because I would have seen the cardboard on the door missing, and that would have helped me spring into action a hell of a lot earlier. A little while later, we heard screaming coming from the inside of my house, and it was a lot of screaming. We jumped up and I grabbed a baseball bat, and Devin grabbed a lacrosse stick, and we went down the stairs to my garage door to the house. The screaming was still happening with a lot of, "Get the fuck out of here!" and "Fuck off, you creep!" cries as well. We ran through the house, and that's when we saw the girls booking it down the stairs, all the while screaming. "What the hell is going on?" I yelled at my sister Katie, and she just said, "Doug's here! Doug's here with a knife!" Somehow, they all got past him and ran down the stairs. One of them had pushed and tripped him, and he was too drunk to actually act too fast. "Take everyone to my room," I shouted, and my sisters led their friends through the kitchen, into the garage, and then up the stairs to my room. Doug came down the stairs, and I told him to leave and that the cops were going to be on their way. He was beyond angry, and he had this big kitchen knife in his hand and was swinging it around in a drunken mess. "You little asshole, come here!" He kept slurring that over and over as he tried to walk towards me. I'm not going to lie. I was scared, and when he got nearer to me, I swung the bat at him. But for some reason, I let go of it, and it sailed away into the living room. To this day, I can't explain why that happened. I yelled for Devin to run, and we took off after the girls. They were all up in my place and couldn't lock the door, as there was a little trick to doing that, and I did it just as Doug started up the stairs, still yelling incomprehensible shit. He started pounding on the door, and I yelled for Katie or Kara to call the cops when we heard a loud bang, followed by yelling, and what sounded like someone falling down the stairs. More sounds came, and it was a mix of thumps and groans and was now out in the driveway. I ran to the window to see a large, dark shadow beating another shadow. Finally, I figured out what was going on, and the big shadow actually lifted Doug off the ground over its head and threw him into some bushes on the side of our house. The big shadow was Ben from across the street. Kara got the cops on the phone and told them what was going on, and I ran downstairs and into the driveway to see Ben just standing there getting rained on with his grin on his face. He had thrown that Doug guy around like a rag doll, and I was in awe. Ben looked at me and smiled, and I said thanks. He just nodded. Long story short, the cops came, reamed my sisters out for having a beer blast underage, took Doug away, and told us they would be coming back to talk to my parents when they got home from vacation. During this time, Ben never said a word and stood at the edges. When everything calmed down, Ben waved at me and started to head for home when I told him to wait up. I went over to thank him, and I found out that night that there was something special about Ben. Ben had Down syndrome and was not a creeper like my sisters thought. He actually considered himself the protector of this section of town, and in a way, he was. Before we got there, Ben had saved a few people from accidents, and over the next few years, Ben saved 3 people from a house fire over a mile away that he ran to in his bare feet when he saw the flames in the distance. Another time he had lifted up an SUV high enough for people to crawl out from under after they had crashed in a ditch, and once on a trip into town, he ran into a building that was collapsing when he heard a kid crying. He saved that kid, too. That night, he must have sensed that something was wrong and just did what he thought was the right thing to do, protect the weak humans across the street. Ben still lives out there with his aging parents, and he's still as strong as ever. I always called him Super Ben, and he loved that. Ben had saved us from a drunken maniac that night, and he's still the only superhero I know. Thanks for listening, gang. Please like, share, and subscribe, and leave a comment with any suggestions below. I respond to all of them, and also consider help keeping this channel ad-free by throwing me a tip at my Patreon page. There's a link for that below. You can also check out my merchandise for this channel and The Edge of the Unknown at UncleJoshTrueScaryStories.Threadless.com. Follow me on social media for channel updates. All the links to those are in the description below. And send me your true scary stories. UncleJoshTrueScaryStories@gmail.com. I read them all. Be excellent to each other, gang. And until next time, be wary of things that go bump in the night. It could be anything. A ghost, a monster, or the guy next door. Once, I bought an antique trunk at a store, and when I got it home, I put it in the garage, intending to clean it up. It was at night, and my garage is pretty poorly lit. Anyway, I noticed in the dim light that there seemed to be smoke in the air. I backed up and realized there was this weird spectral form over the trunk, and it slowly shaped itself into a figure that looked vaguely like a guy in 19th century dress. It scared the crap out of me. "Who are you?" I said, and the figure just stared. "Did you used to own this trunk?" I asked. The figure nodded slowly. "Oh my God, can I take your picture to prove you exist?" Again, the figure nodded. I ran and got the camera, and the figure was slowly starting to fade away. I quickly aimed the camera and shot the picture, but the batteries in the flash attachment were dead. The figure disappeared, and I haven't seen it since, and I don't even have any photographic proof, even though the ghost seemed to give me permission. So, I guess you could say, the spirit was willing, but the flash was weak.